Thank you very much, Christy. Mesdames, Messieurs, ladies and gentlemen, first of all, let me thank Professor Petit for her generous invitation to come here and lecture at Collège de France. It's a great honor for me personally. It's actually the Swedish National Day today, so it fits very well. I feel tremendous joy and excitement being here sharing the results of the past 10 years of my research with you. I'm also very happy to be here and share the joy with Professor Petit and her latest success, which I'm sure you all heard that she got the Kavli Prize, which is an enormous prestigious award, and I think I can appreciate how much hard work, dedication, and stamina it takes. So I'm very proud of you. I don't think you know how lucky you are to have her, actually, if I may say so. So today we're going to talk about, the talk says, from tempo to tears, sounds rather cryptical, early level processing of sound rhythms in the mammalian brain. Now, what has this picture got to do with that? See, as you all see here, this spiral, this painting was done in the early 20th century by an artist called Hilma af Klint. She was a Swedish engineer and artist, and she was most active in the beginning of the last century. And she was frequently painting spirals like this. And this is rather similar to the cochlea. The small but fantastic and intricate organ hidden here in the temporal bone, in the inner ear, by which we can hear. Without the cochlea, there will be no sound, or we will perceive nothing. Interestingly enough, she's also painting here what I think looks like a kidney. Don't you think? It looks a bit like a kidney. And these are two bodies, of course, and man and woman, yin and yang, and all that. And at that time, 1908, we didn't know that the cochlea and the kidney had very similar mechanisms of generating their fluids. They have a very similar filtration mechanism. And now these days, of course, we know due to new fancy tools that this is due to specific ion channels, i.e. proteins that filter electrolytes and so on in a very specific manner. We now understand why certain drugs that affect the kidney will also affect the hearing and so forth. Now, what do I want to say with this picture? I want to point out how important it is to have intuition when you do science. Now, what is intuition? Well, ladies and gentlemen, there's nothing else than the subcortical brain at act. It's your subconscious brain comparing patterns from your previous experience, and therefore you can extrapolate, and you do that without even thinking about it. And today we're going to submerge into the subcortical brain. Okay? So, now we move over to the communication part. Humans have what the Germans would call a Mitteilungsbedürfnis. That is, we have an internal drive, a need to take an interest in the world and share it with others, to communicate with each other. I have an urge now to tell you about my research, and I'm really excited about it. It's an affective attunement. You can feel how excited I am about it. Hopefully I will transfer some skills or knowledge to you, and thereby we bond together. We form a little community here. So communication makes our lives very meaningful. So in that sense, verbal communication, but also sign language, of course, makes our lives meaningful. So to understand the brain processes, the circuits, the neural mechanisms that underlie communication is essential, at least not to promote high quality of life. Now, I try to understand the overall question is how we can receive communication sounds, that is, verbal or vocal communication. And more specifically, I want to try and understand how we can single out those socially relevant sounds from other sounds. All mammals, and especially humans, have a unique capacity to single out as I said, socially relevant sounds from other sounds. And what's is the most characteristic aspect of vocalization? Well, essentially, as I speak to you now, it's just a pulse of my vocal cords clapping together. And from that, you will extract the distinct units that will form specific acoustical objects, which eventually will enable you to comprehend what I'm saying. Isn't that rather fantastic? Now, if you look at these distinct units, they all fall under the concept of rhythm. So this is a rather slow temporal processing, but it's still absolutely necessary for us to perceive speech. And in fact, the speech rhythm itself is a form of communication, and it's innate to us, illustrated here by, perhaps you've seen this, is talking twins. Let's see whether I can start the... Anyway, while we're waiting, I think you get the gist of the whole thing, that these twins are actually, perhaps you can hear it, are actually communicating with each other just based on the vocalization rhythm. Another example is, of course, the fantastic invention of the cochlear implant, discovered by Ingeborg Hochmeier, Graham Clark, and Blake Wilson, where basically you pick up the speech signal and you filter out the contour and then translate that into an electrical pulse train, which you then stimulate the remaining nerve of the cochlea, and that pulse is transmitted to the brain, and the person who is deaf can actually perceive speech. Now, this is provided that it's either implanted when you're very young and can develop speech and language during the critical periods, or that you have acquired deafness postlingually, that is, that the network is in place. Now, I cannot tell you what it will sound when you have a cochlear implant, but I had copied a sound file of Morse language, you know, Morse, the Morse code. That would be something similar. We all know that we can perceive a Morse code, just these tone beeps, these tone blips, basically, we can perceive as meaningful language. And especially gifted people can pick it up immediately as they hear it, more or less, that have a temporal, that are specialized for temporal processing, basically. So a problem that arises in the endeavor to understand these, the speech processing and how it happens in the brain is that, of course, in humans, it's a higher cognitive functions that would be colored by all the levels of the brain. So it's rather difficult to single out the basic acoustic feature detection, for instance, and distinguish that from phonetic cognitive functions that involve learning and memory. So animal models are attractive for studying these basic mechanisms. Hi, I have a problem again here. I tried to connect the sound. And this is a famous experiment by Patricia Kuhl, who in her early career actually studied... Yeah, I connected that, but it's still... Let's see if it works now, then. Okay, otherwise we take it as it is. Thank you. She studied animals, and she trained the animals to distinguish between different speech units, human speech units, such as phonemes, syllables, and words. And the psychometric function here, the 50% correct choice, will correspond to the phonetic boundaries. And as you see, a chinchilla is doing equally well to a human at distinguishing the difference between different consonants, for instance. So we know that the basic feature detection of speech sounds is an innate property and is, in fact, a basic acoustic mechanism present in all vocalizing mammals. So we have used mice as a model. Mice are a very social species. They have a rich repertoire of sounds. They have specific pup calls that will attract the mother to the pups. They actually sing. They have a courtship song. Did you know that? And this is actually a stretch of mouse song, which we have extracted from Timothy Holley's publication online. And we've taken a closer look at it. And already by looking at it, you can see that it's segmented. So the amplitude modulations are very sharp. And you can actually guess that there are distinct units here, which we call calls, which may be equivalent to our syllables. And then there are bouts of calls, which we know are behaviorally meaningful to the mice, and that would be something equivalent to words. So mice communicate also with distinct units. And just to check, because we couldn't find it in the literature, so we took the contour of the mouse calls, and then we did a power spectral density analysis to see how they are modulated. And as you see, they are also modulated in a rhythmical manner. So mice also communicate with a sort of communication rhythm. So we think it's a valid model to study the basic acoustical principles. So the question is then, where in the brain does it start? Where is the temporal information in vocalized communication processed in the brain? Of course, it starts in the cochlea, but then the auditory brain works in the following manner. You have specific cells that give rise to specific projection patterns. So you have what we call nuclei, which is a collection of neurons fulfilling similar functions. And in the auditory brain, it would perhaps correspond to a specific feature, such as sound localization cues or spectral cues, or why not the cause temporal cues? And that's what the hypothesis we are nurturing. And what we know from the previous literature is that the basic feature detections happens already on the brainstem level. The auditory system is an ancient sensory system, starting with the lateral line in fishes. And therefore, most of the processing happens already on the brainstem and midbrain level, and the auditory cortex is comparatively small if we compare to visual cortex. Not that I want to minimize the visual system, it's just another hierarchical processing strategy, basically. So it's not so strange to focus on the lower level processing in the auditory system. And one area that has been particularly studied is the superior olivary complex in the ventral part of the brainstem. And we're talking the mammalian brainstem here now. And I've highlighted four structures for you. So the more lateral and medial parts here are involved in sound, extracting sound localization cues. And I think other lecturers have dealt with those aspects, so we're not going to talk about that today. There are two other structures here, the superior paraolivary nucleus, which I will go introduce you to now. And I also want to mention the medial nucleus of the trapezoid body, which is a structure which is believed to be a relay station that convey inhibition to all of these nuclei. And the role of this inhibition is still not understood. What else do we know about SPON? Why do we think that the SPON, as I will refer to it from now on, may be important for extracting these rhythmical cues? First of all, the SPON is present in all mammals investigated thus far. And what is a bit special is that, in contrast to the other nuclei, such as the lateral and medial superior olive here, is that it does not vary particularly in size. The other nuclei vary depending on the animal's hearing range. Some animals prefer high frequencies and other prefer to communicate more in the low frequency range depending on their ecological niche, so to speak. And therefore, these nuclei are then varying in size, which is not the case for the SPON. So presumably it's not so important for the spawn. It's homing in on other cues, so to speak. Yes, that's important to know. What more did we know about the spawn when we started studying it? Well, a hallmark was that it responds to a contralaterally presented tone. So what does that mean? It means that if you record from an anesthetized animal and at the same time present a sound, you know, hearing works even though you sleep. That's an amazing feature of the auditory system if you want to study it, because you can actually, without problem, have a deeply anesthetized animal and it still works. So if you present a sound and record from the spawn on one side of the brain, nothing will happen if you present the sound on the same side as your recording. However, if you present the sound at the opposite side of where you are recording, it will not fire during the tone, but at the offset of the tone. And that was shown by Albert Barebi and his group. I want to highlight him in this context. And it also means it's not binaural, or as yet, it's probably not binaural. We shall see later in my talk. Spawn also responds to amplitude-modulated tones, which is quite similar to the speech rhythm or the speech envelope. So, as I said, it doesn't fire to a single tone itself, but if you amplitude-modulate the tone, wow, 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 so it's fluctuating, it will fire very precisely in synchrony with that rhythm, as you see here. Also, if you present it contralaterally. So these properties have led to the hypothesis that this nucleus would be very suitable for extracting the sound rhythm from vocalizations. So if we want to prove that hypothesis, we have to investigate these neurons and pathways in a Cartesian order. You start from the beginning, kind of, and then you move forward. And we have to, of course, know, if I say that there are specific input pathways carrying specific information, it's important to understand what inputs these neurons are getting, because otherwise we don't really understand what this structure is doing. So that was one goal, to understand what input pathways come to spawn. And also we want to understand the neurons themselves. You see, a neuron can look very exciting in a way, right? It has these dendrites extending, it has smaller dendrites, and it has something here in the membrane, and these are proteins, and these proteins can carry electrolytes, as I said, and that will regulate the intracellular milieu, much like we have a homeostasis where we regulate our blood pressure, if we're hungry, our temperature. The neuron needs to regulate its electrical milieu. That's the important aspect for a neuron's survival. And these are all carried out by ion channels. So we want to understand the electrical properties of the neurons. So we know that the spawn receives a major feed-forward inhibition from the MNTB, which I mentioned before, is a relay nucleus within the superior olivary complex that projects to the SPON, the spawn. In other words, the spawn gets inhibited by sounds projected from the contralateral ear. You can follow the projection pathway from the ventral acoustic stria back to the cochlear nucleus and the Bushi cells, which receive input from the auditory nerve, which in turn gets activated from the hair cells. Now, the only question that arises here, why inhibition? I've shown you that these neurons are activated by sound. Inhibition normally quench activity. So how does that fit together? So that was the first question we had to resolve. If they, this was the known input at the time, how can inhibition be translated into activity? Because this is rather unusual for the brain. So we turned to a technique called the patch clamp technique, discovered by Sackmann and Neer, where you produce acute brain slices. So you anesthetize the animal, kill the animal, take out the brain. You slice the brain very quickly, and then you keep it oxygenated in artificial cerebrospinal fluid. And then the neurons survive for several hours. And if you put it under the microscope, you can see what the actual spawn neurons look like. These are the spawn neurons. So that's how they will look in your brain now. They're rather large multipolar cells. And then we go down with a glass microelectrode and we latch onto individual neurons and we suck a little hole so that we have a free exchange between the pipette and the cell, and thereby we can control the intracellular milieu, which I told you is how these neurons survive and operate in a way how they communicate. So then we can artificially control how these neurons produce spikes, and we can also stimulate the remaining inputs in this slice. I also want to mention to you that this is done during during a developmental period where the auditory system is not fully mature. The auditory system of the brain then relies on a functioning cochlea. So in mice, the hearing organ is functioning at postnatal day 10. In humans, that would correspond to about 4.5 months in utero. And this maturation ends around 20 days after birth, whereas it corresponds to the birth in humans. And then, of course, there's a fine-tuning of the auditory system, which goes on for years, in mice and rats for months. And some say our brains mature until we're 25, 30 years old, after which it starts declining, alas. We do expect changes, and you will see that there are some changes that takes place as the system starts to find you. However, at hearing onset, everything is there in place, and it's operating in the manner it should. So it's a question of fine-tuning thereafter. So we can say something about the function, although it may become faster or something along these lines. So what did we find? So when we record from the spawn neurons and with our amplifier, we can then inject currents through the electrode so that the voltage then changes in the neuron. And the neuron will communicate in an all or nothing fashion with what we call a spike or an action potential. And if you depolarize the neuron, you make it more positive, at a certain level, you get a spike. And that happens also in the spawn neurons, as it should, because that's a hallmark of all neurons in the brain, at least projection neurons. If we then hyperpolarize the neuron, which would be equivalent of inhibiting it, and we know that the spawn is inhibited during sounds, we first of all, we see that there's a voltage sag, so the voltage starts to become more negative, but then it sort of deflects back, okay, as if something makes it bounce back. And the second thing we observe is that we trigger a spike at the end of the hyperpolarization. And now that's what we call a rebound spike. It's also an action potential. Now what this told us was that, okay, now we understand why hyperpolarization or inhibition can cause the spawn neurons to spike. We had to find out more about the spikes, though. As I mentioned to you, this is during a relatively early development, and the rebound spiking did not change. I mean, all these spawn neurons have rebound spiking, and during all developmental periods, they have rebound spiking. What happens is that it gets faster with time. So with development, they develop properties that makes the spike more fast and i.e. more precise, indicating that these neurons care about being fast and precise. The question is how they can produce rebound spikes at all. And as I mentioned to you, these proteins now come into the picture that carry the ion currents that control the intracellular milieu. Now, these are old theories by Hodgkin and Huxley, building upon voltage-sensitive, voltage-gated ion channels. And here I have just listed a few currents that would be affected by hyperpolarization, because this is now the main interest, how the rebound spike would be created. So if we now switch to a voltage clamp, which means that instead of injecting a current in the neuron, we clamp the voltage of it. So we keep the intracellular milieu constant, and then we observe what currents are flowing over the membrane when we do that. And then we can see here, if we hyperpolarize the spawn neuron, we see these lines. Without going into details, that's indicative of a current then. And if it's a downward deflecting current, it goes in to the neuron. And you see, the more we hyperpolarize, the more current we get. Now, this is called the age current. It's an hyperpolarization activated current, which is a mix of two positively charged ions, sodium and calcium. So if they flow in as we hyperpolarize, they will keep depolarizing the neuron more and more and more. It's like a bow and arrow, like this, more and more. And as we release it, the arrow goes off and rebound spiking occurs. So the age current is very prominent in these neurons. Another type of current is a calcium current called T-type, for those of you who are interested. And that current is also depending on hyperpolarization to be active. And that current would be expected also to sort of boost the spiking activity, because you may imagine that it's important to... if we now think it's important for detecting the edge of these distinct units, it has to be a very rapid depolarization, which then triggers a spike. And this current is also very prominent then. So if we block the currents pharmacologically, this is sort of the golden standard to prove that something is functional. You first find out what proteins are there, what currents they express, but then you have to block them to prove their function. And in vitro, in these cells, if we block the age or the T current, you see that the rebound spiking is affected by both in slightly different manners. IH affects the latency more, whereas the T current prevents it from breaking through as a spike. Okay? So these currents do seem to act in tandem, but a skeptic would say, what about the offset response in vivo then? Does it have anything to do with that? So the next thing we have to do to prove the causal link between these ion channels, the rebound, and finally the offset, we have to block them in vivo. So we did that. We record from the spawn whilst presenting a sound or a tone contralaterally, and then we sequentially block these two currents and observe the recovery, of course. And what you see is that both the age current and the T current contribute to rebound spiking, and if you block both at the same time, you completely abolish the offset spiking. So that was the proof that inhibition causes rebound spiking by activating these two currents that will generate the offset response when the sound ends. Now, I just want to point out to you that we see a small onset response here too. I'm going to come back to that. So also the amplitude modulated tones then, what happens to the rhythmic modulations? And the same thing there, we tested sequential blockade using of the tea and age currants, and we did it in reverse order as well. And indeed, the same thing happens here, that they fire less well in synchrony, and if both currents are blocked, the capacity to follow this rhythm is abolished. So that means rebound spiking is actually underlying the spiking to these rhythmic modulations. So the first conclusion is spawn responds with spiking activity to the offset of a pure tone. Spawn neurons fire in synchrony with amplitude modulated tones, i.e. the sound rhythm. Spawn neurons are equipped for rebound spiking, and rebound spiking depends on two hyperpolarization-dependent currents, namely IH and IT, and blocking them in vivo abolishes spawn's capacity for rebound spiking at the offset to a tone or its modulations. So the next question we asked ourselves then, okay, if this is important for conveying vocalization rhythms, what happens in the deaf condition? Deafness occurs in about 1 to 700 births, according to Professor Petit's research and knowledge. And the leading treatment of congenital deafness today is actually the cochlear implant, which I mentioned to you before, which then will convey the speech rhythm as a pulse train directly to the brain. Now, that's all good and fine and wonderful. However, there's quite a large variability in the outcome of these implants. And if you speak to the surgeons, I mean, I work close to a cochlear implant unit, they say that we put in the electrode exactly the same way and we cannot explain this variability. So one hypothesis was that the temporal processing on the brainstem level may be affected. So we thought, okay, let's look at the spawn then and see how that develops. So then we turn to a mouse model where a certain ion channel, which you know now what it is, it's a protein, was knocked out from the hair cells, which prevents the synaptic transmission, i.e. The transduction of the mechanical vibrations to bioelectrical signals, the spikes in the auditory nerves, disappears, which is illustrated here by measuring with a brainstem response, showing that there's no, I don't know why the, where's the reference? That's the reference. That there's no activity coming into the brainstem, basically. So will the lack of auditory nerve activity affect the development of spawn neurons and their capacity for rebound spiking? As you know now, you recognize this is the hallmark of a spawn neuron. You get a sag and a rebound spike upon hyperpolarization. If we compare the control with the knockout mice without auditory nerve activity, we found an abnormal rebound spiking. You see, it's much wider. So the question would then be, would the control be a more precise? Would that convey the temporal code more precisely than in the animal lacking auditory nerve activity? So we wanted to observe what happened to the rebound spiking over time. To our surprise, it actually normalized fairly rapidly. I mean, first of all, they had capacity for rebound spiking, although it was more of a bursting character, which is a hallmark of the calcium currents I told you about before. So the calcium currents are obviously still there, but it's the latency or the duration is more affected. However, that normalized over time, over the first 2 weeks in these animals. So the question is, how could that happen then? You know now that the sag and the rebound are the characteristic features. So if we looked at those features over time, we saw that the voltage sag was significantly less developed in the knockout. So that means they are less voltage sensitive, basically, which could be a response to the lack of activity or the lack of input. Whereas the duration, as we saw first, is it's a much wider response, which then normalized over the first 2 weeks and become quite normal again, actually,
even without activity.
So then we looked at the age current, which is essential for this rebound spiking. And we saw in the first developmental period, it was almost not present in these neurons, very little age current. And then it sort of miraculously is upregulated over time. At 12 days after birth, it's normal. And if we normalize it to the cell size, to look at the current density, it's actually overtaking the control animal, so they express more of the age current, okay? But that didn't explain the absence of the SAG. So then we started to look at different measures indicating that there may be different subunits of this protein. So these channels are consisting of different subunits which will provide slightly different kinetics and voltage sensitivity. And you may think, does that matter so much? But as you see here, it does matter. Because, without going into details, we looked at the time constants, which is indicating the relationship between two subtypes called 1 and 2, where 1 is faster, but has the drawback that it needs high voltage sensitivity. The other one is slightly slower, but it has the advantage that you don't need much of a voltage change. And that's precisely the subunit that's upregulated in these neurons. So the brain has the capacity then to modulate the stoichiometry of these two units and thereby compensating for the lack of inputs. And thereby it rescues the function of the rebound. So the second conclusion was that rebound spiking is present and it has normalizes in the deaf spawn, although it's a staggered development. And this is due to sequential compensation mechanisms, first acting by calcium currents and then is further normalized by upregulation of age current via the two-type channel subunit. So that means that the robustness of this pathway was quite remarkable to us. And in fact, that may be a prerequisite why it works so well with the cochlear implant. Because it's so resilient to change, that made us believe that, okay, if this pathway is so important for conveying the speech rhythm upon which the cochlear implant builds, and that is so robust, then this is probably a prerequisite for the success. On the other hand, we can conclude that the individual variability is likely due to other factors. So that's probably due to cognitive variability, for instance, which we're going to come back to. So the next question we attacked was then the source of excitation to spawn. As I told you, we have an onset response, which is indicative of an excitatory input. Now, that had been reported in the literature, but no one had really focused on it, or people thought it's not really significant in a way. At the same time, anatomists had shown that there could be a potential octopus cell input to the spawn. And I'm going to explain to you a little bit what the octopus cell is doing. However, these track tracing studies indicated now it could be several other cell types. And is it monaural? Is it binaural? Does it get input from one or two sides? It was not really known. And the fact that the literature was highlighting a multitude of inputs to spawn makes it very difficult to make a conclusion or a statement about the function, since these neurons fulfill totally different sensory processing functions in the auditory system. So which one is it then, kind of? So we decided to clarify that once and for all. So we first started recording again from our brain slices and look at the connections. You remember from the slide that there are synapses. These are the connections between the inputs and the neurons. And we can record those connections as currents here going into the spawn neurons. And essentially, when we stimulate the inputs, in steps, so you gradually increase the stimulation strength, you should see increments in the amplitude of these currents corresponding to their connections, because you recruit more and more connections corresponding to more and more fibers in the input pathway. Now, if we do that in spawn neurons, you see there are very few steps. One, two. It's quite clear here, we count. And later in development, one, two. So there are very few inputs. So, okay, that kind of casts doubts. Does it really matter then? But as you see, the size of the actual input increase with development. So they are innervated by a few inputs in the slice. Of course, we have severed the inputs, but we compared to other neurons as well in other nuclei. And by comparison, they get few but strong inputs. Now, that is compatible with a more or less all-or-nothing response, or not a tremendously graded response. And this fits with the octopus cells in the cochlear nucleus. So the octopus cells correspond to a specific cell type then in the first relay where the auditory nerve comes in, and it's located in a specific part of the cochlear nucleus, the posterior ventral part. And as you see, they look a bit like an octopus, hence the name. It has dendrite extending from the cell body, covering all the frequency lamina, meaning that they sample very broadly over many, many frequencies. So they would be expected to respond to broadband stimuli. Another characteristic is that they're very temporally precise. So they have properties, cellular properties, their ion channels will act as filters which enable them to only fire once at a broadband transient. So here they have, this is Donata Ertel together with Philip Joris, who's been here too, where they present clicks. And as you see, the octopus neuron can follow these clicks very, very precisely with very low jitter here. And that's another hallmark. So they would be expected to follow broadband transients. Now, what is that? That is the glottal pulses of my voice speaking now, basically. So the octopus cells are believed to be important for carrying vocalization rhythms through, presumably through specific pathways then. So when we backtrace the inputs from the spawn, we indeed find a pathway called the intermediate acoustic stria, where the octopus cells of the contralateral octopus neurons are present as a target. So that the tracer, which we inject specifically into the spawn, is transported retrogradely back to its origin, and we only found labeling in the PVCN and the octopus cells, provided that the injection was precise enough. If we had the slightest spread, you got many different cell types. So that illustrates it's quite difficult to do these experiments. Now, still, it doesn't look very impressive, this projection. But fortunately enough, we found a marker, without going into detail what that does. But that marker highlighted the intermediate acoustic stria. And to our surprise, we saw that this weak projection coming in here from the contralateral side fans out as it reaches the ventral brainstem. And it goes to the spawn. Okay, voila. So that explains the strong fibers, the strong excitation from a few fibers, probably indicating that these fibers are projecting in a diverged way rather than a converging way. But what's missing is the connection to the onset response in vivo. So that was the next question we addressed. So if we now think that, okay, we know now for a fact they only get octopus cell input, right, from the contralateral side. So what differed then from other studies was that they had presented pure tones. That doesn't really fit with these broadband transients. So we just stimulated simply with pure tones and compared it to broadband noise bursts. And then, as you see, it's a very simple experiment, but very effective. You see, with the pure tone, you get the characteristic offset. In the same neuron, you present a broadband noise stimulus. Voila, you get a very strong onset response in these neurons. So that sort of, although it's kind of indirect, it's a very strong evidence for a functional octopus cell projection to the spawn. And this onset spiking, moreover, got more accurate. I mean, we do observe occasional onset response with a tone. However, it gets much more accurate with a broadband stimulus. So, okay, previous studies had not thought much of this onset, but now it's there, it's strong. So what is it doing during communication? So we decided to test natural vocalizations in mice to see what happens to the onset respective offset response. I mean, that's exciting because, I mean, does it now follow the envelope? Does it mark the edge? Is it an onset offset? What's going on? So we used low frequency harmonic calls. Now these are mouse calls that will be important during aversive situation. The mouse is aggressive or angry or something like that. And they signal that with specific calls. And these are three different types of calls. So you can see the fundamental frequency, which is very low for a mouse. And you see the overtones here. And we also plotted the envelope. And Boris Gurevich, who's a collaborator, is here in the audience, whom I've done this together with. And as you see here, you see that the envelope, you know, you see the onset, you see the offset, and then the amplitude varies during the call. If we compare to a pure tone where the spawn neuron responds with an offset, in contrast then with the call, first of all, we see a dual spiking response. So there are two spiking time events, basically. But the first one, presumably being the onset response, doesn't necessarily only mark the onset, but it fires more to the maximum envelope or during the envelope of the call. So that means that the offset is fairly frequency specific, and the onset is a broadly tuned response, which basically seem to be able to follow the envelope. This is something we have to investigate further. The frequency-specific effect is even more highlighted if we choose a neuron where the best frequency is even further away from the fundamental frequency of the call. So the previous one had a best frequency of 10 kilohertz, now we're at 16 kilohertz. Compared to the 3-4 kilohertz call. And then you see that the offset response is often not even there, while the onset response is now, in fact, the prominent response. Okay, so that means that all spawn neurons respond with an onset response, whether it's tuned to the sound or not, as long as it's a wideband sound. So that means it's a population code coming from the whole spawn during these broadband transients, whereas the offset will only fire if the spawn neuron is specifically tuned to the fundamental frequency or its overtone. So what do we think that means? Well, first of all, we have to understand that the output from the spawn is inhibitory. So it's purely inhibitory to the next level, which is the inferior colliculus, and that's the main processing hub in the auditory system. That's where all these pathways converge, and we build combinations of different features which will produce then not an infinite but an unprecedented combination of different acoustic properties, which will then build a gestalt at higher levels. And we don't really understand how this combination occurs yet. But the inhibition is quite substantial coming from the spawn, so it's one of the main contributors of inhibition.
And we hypothesize now that this dual inhibition from SPON is actually an adaptation to perceive vocalized sounds. Because if you have a call with the fundamental frequency and its overtone, the onset response will then fire from all SPON neurons, which will provide a wideband inhibition to the next level. And that wideband inhibition is going to quench activity. So any kind of random activity here and there is going to be blocked during this particular call. At the sound offset or the call offset, the SPON neurons that will correspond specifically to these frequencies will, of course, produce an inhibition that will summate if it corresponds in time. So that's called temporal summation. So 1, 2, 3, 4 will summate and occur exactly at the same time. Now that will, of course, sculpt out a bump here in activity on the next level. And that hyperpolarization, as you know now, can of course trigger rebound spiking at the next level. But only if they coincide in time. If there's another natural sound with sloppy edges here, they may not be strong enough to trigger the rebound spiking, and they will drown in the preceding wideband inhibition. So this is a way to improve the signal-to-noise ratio. And signal-to-noise ratio is everything in speech. You know, people who get a hearing aid, for instance, they often leave it in the drawer because they say, I don't care if we amplify the sound because the signal-to-noise ratio is not better anyway, so it's just unpleasant for me when you amplify all the sounds. And that could be because we don't get to mechanisms like this. Now, to prove that, we have started to investigate that, and we have performed so-called dual recordings. So these are actually quite difficult experiments. These are done by Richard Felix, who's done a postdoc in my lab, where he records from the SPON and the IC at the same time. And he makes sure they respond to the same stimuli, and then he blocks the inhibition specifically in the SPON and sees what happened to the response at the next level. And when he does that, and he blocks the SPON-derived inhibition, you will see that the capacity to follow these amplitude-modulated tones gets significantly worse here, indicating that we're on the right track, at least. So, all of these animals were done in mice so far. However, it's very important to have a cross-species perspective when you study speech or communication. Needless to say, because the cognitive processes that are governed by the implicit bottom-up processes, which I've talked about now, cannot be studied in humans. We cannot take brain slices and study feature detection in humans. And at the other same time, the explicit cognitive functions are not possible to study in animals. I cannot ask my mouse, what do you hear? Or how do you feel when you hear this sound? So the take-home message is we need to concurrently study mice and men, basically, to understand these complex pathways. And one aspect which is very poorly understood is the emotional content that the sound rhythm convey. It tells us something about the state of the speaker. It's a way to effectively color the voice, make it more attractive to the receiver, and I believe it's also important for learning. I hope that woke you up. So if we look, for instance, at adult-directed speech, this is from a review by Patricia Kuhl, which later moved on to humans, which is fairly unemotional. I mean, I try to be businesslike with you here now. I'm not here to emotionally manipulate you. So, you know, I'm fairly straightforward, not much modulation here, right? If we look at infant-directed speech, where we want to attract the attention and we want the person to learn, can you say, ah? Say, ah. Hey, you. We modulate our voice consciously. And that's to make this affective modulation makes the voice much more attractive to us humans. Now, how that happens is very poorly understood. And it probably involves all the evolutionary control levels of the brain. So could the SPON be involved in conveying that information too through its rhythm? So interestingly enough, it does project to limbic areas, such as the deep layers of the superior colliculus and the periaqueductal gray, which are areas that are involved in sensing the internal state of the body and responding with goal-directed motor actions. For instance, laughing spontaneously. And the TLC is a newly discovered reticular structure, which we don't know what it's doing. However, the TLC gets input from paleocortical and limbic structures. Now, paleocortex is the oldest part of the cortex. And if we talk about zona inserta or cingulate cortex, it's involved in emotional processing. So the question is then whether the TLC would be a suitable hub between the spawn and the affective emotions that the voice or other sounds, such as music, is carrying. But the TLC is difficult to trace from because it's a reticular structure. So we are pursuing another hypothesis. We are looking for an emotional readout, an affective emotional readout between the sound, basically, that can be triggered by sound and could be carried via the spawn. And weeping, it's not very investigated, but that's perhaps the most emotional readout of them all, in my opinion. So just by looking at this picture, you should be feeling something. And if you heard the person express his or her grief, some of you would probably start crying. This is a very, very human function, which has to do with empathy. And but it's basically an unconscious mechanism. You all know listening to a piece of music, or so you cannot really understand why do I get so moved now, or when this person is speaking, and so forth. Now, I have a postdoc, Marcelo Gomez Alvarez, and he's pursuing the idea that there may be a connection between the spawn and the pathways controlling weeping. Now, whether animals weep or not, that can be debated, but there are anecdotes that elephants cry, for instance, and so forth. But what's known is that the lacrimal glands that produce tears, those pathways are the same in all mammals. So if you put a tracer in the lacrimal gland and trace it back through the pterygopalatine ganglion, you will target a small group of neurons, parasympathetic neurons, called the superior salivatory nucleus, which is very closely located to the spawn, actually. And the only thing known about the SSN is that it gets a reticular top-down control, which is GABAergic. So he's following that, or we are following the hypothesis that there may be an old emotional gateway between the spawn and the TLC and the SSN. For instance, spawn could, during sound activation, disinhibit the TLC, which in turn disinhibits the SSN. So this is under exploration. And we received funding from the Mexican Research Council a couple of years ago to do this. And this year, it turns out that a New Zealand group studying rabbits by fluke were looking at something else and put a tracer in the lacrimal gland because they wanted to test the method of using rabies virus. And surprise, surprise, they find the spawn is highlighted. So we may not be so far off here with our hypothesis. So we'll see what happens. The next thing, as I said, we need to understand then in humans how these bottom-up processes affect speech comprehension. And here, I suppose you all heard about Laurel and Janney. See where I can get this going. These rhythmical, the rhythm information is actually fundamental for comprehending words and what they mean. I.e. lexical
language. Laurel. Laurel. Laurel.
Do you hear Yanni? How many hear Yanni?
Laurel.
Or Laurel.
Laurel. Laurel. Laurel.
So 50% or so of the population here, Yanny, and 50% here, Laurel. And this is because, of course, this stimulus is slightly artificial because it has more overtones than normally. But basically, brains can prefer to either home in on the low frequencies or the high frequencies and the envelope produced by this speech stimulus. So that means that this rhythmic information can also, when you listen to it, give rise to totally different interpretations. Now, another example where a tonal modulation can change the meaning of a word completely is actually Swedish language. Swedish language is a pitch accent language. So if I speak Swedish to you now, you would perceive it as I'm singing or something like that, probably. It's called the Swedish lilt. So, as I said, that means that just the accent or the intonation of the word can change the meaning of it completely. I just copied here from Google, music, museum. It's a very subtle difference to the accent on the U here, which gives rise to totally different lexical retrieval from the memory pathways of the brain, and you either pick up music or museum long before you actually hear the entire word. So brain processing of spoken language can be picked up by EEG, which are event-related potentials. And if we discovered specific cell pathways, we discovered specific cells, specific pathways before, this is totally the opposite. This is the summated response of all the processing from the cochlea to the cortex. And these potentials are unattentive, so they are pre-attentive. These potentials will occur if you are asleep, if you are anesthetized, if you're in a deep coma, they still occur. So these waveforms that we get from repeating stimuli many, many times, thousands of times, and averaging them, will provide a fingerprint of all the bottom-up processing that reached the cortex, including the cortex. And we capitalize on something called the mismatch negativity, which occurs, which is a negative ERP potential occurring if you present a deviating stimulus within a sequence of other stimuli. And this is called, this mismatch negativity is called the MMN response, and a lot of people all over the world are investigating that. I'm totally new to that now, so I apologize, I don't have all the knowledge, of course, but here you see the ERP waveform, and the mismatch negativity is specifically at around 200 milliseconds. So say 180 to 250 milliseconds. And there are also other waves here. As you see, they're called P2 and N400. And these are all pre-attentive signals. So what we do then to trigger this mismatch negativity during an auditory stimulation is that we use a frequent standard, a word, as you will see, and we have a rare deviant target. And it works in the following fashion. If you have a meaningful word, it would trigger a stronger MMN response than a nonsense word, for instance. So now I want to know, can we find a signature which reflects the bottom-up affective emotional processes and distinguish them from emotional lexical processing? I want to know. So I suggested that we use the following word. It's a Swedish word which either mean, depending on the accent, period, as in periodic signals, that's rather fitting, or fasen, that's a mild swear word, like blast or so, something along these lines in Swedish. And then, just to show you what it is.
Fasen.
Or?
Fasen.
That's a swear word. And then we also modulate the voice.
Fasen.
It's an angry voice.
Fasen.
And then we present the stimulus.
Fasen. 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 Fasen.
to a subject then. I do this in collaboration with the linguistics department at Stockholm University and an experimental psychologist, Professor Mary Rudner, at Linköping University, which is my home university, as you know now, where they work with this kind of stuff. So the three of us came up with these experiments, and we actually...
Fasen, 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 fasen.
So, we have done this now in 20 subjects, and we analyzed the data, and we will present them next week at the MMN conference in Helsinki. We do find a signature. We have found a signature of this bottom-up affective processing. It was not as we thought, perhaps, but it's very, very clear, very strong, and... perhaps, since I don't show the data here, I can say it's an N400 response. It's hugely affected by this, and we don't know what that means. So that's exciting. So you can come to Helsinki. So to summarize here now, before I take some questions, SPON receives input from the two most temporally precise auditory pathways in the brain, the MNTB, and the octopus neurons in the cochlear nucleus. SPON neurons are equipped for rebound spiking, which is slow but precise. SPON responds with precise on-off spiking to broadband sounds, which convey coarse temporal information about sound, the sound envelope to the next brain level. SPON is a hardwired structure that functions in the deaf condition. SPON is expected to carry information about the temporal pattern, i.e. the symbolic value, remember the Morse code, and the affective tuning, the emotional value of the voice. And language provides means to understand the interaction of sense and sensibility of vocalizations. And finally, I want to thank my lab. I would be nothing without them, and my precious collaborators. This is Marcello doing the anatomical tract tracing. Sarah did a PhD with me. She's working with Stephen Roper in Miami now with the taste system. Katrin Fondersen, is working as a teacher in our department and has done the patch clamping. Richard has done a lot of the in vivo recording and the patch clamping. Stefan investigated the deaf condition. Boris, thank you very much, is collaborating with analysis in vivo and in vitro recordings. Tobias is our engineer, a physicist from the Technical Institute in Stockholm, and Hatice, the latest collaborator at Stockholm University. And finally, thank you for your attention.